Dan to Cody, from Gillette to Rock Springs, this is Let's Talk Wyoming, your weekly dose of Wyoming politics. Because politics may be complicated, but I'm here to break it down and help you make sense of it all. I'm Amy Edmonds, former legislator from Cheyenne. Thanks for being here. Welcome back to Let's Talk Wyoming. I'm your host, Amy Edmonds, and today we're diving into a bill with a name only Washington, D.C. could love or hate, depending on who you ask. It's called the One Big Beautiful Bill, and it's been labeled everything from a tax break for billionaires to major cuts in Medicaid. But are any of those true? I've brought in someone who knows the real story, Tyler Lindholm, Wyoming State Director for Americans for Prosperity, former legislator, rancher, and professional BS detector, and one of my favorite people in the world of Wyoming politics. Tyler, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. I really appreciate the opportunity. I especially like the title of being a professional BS detector, because I've got it over here, man. There's a lot going on currently.
Great. So before we get started, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about Americans for Prosperity and you, the Wyoming chapter, Cowboys for Prosperity, and what you do?
Yeah. So Americans for Prosperity, it's, as I like to explain it, is a center-right nonprofit. We don't take sides as far as political parties or anything like that. We do tend to land with Republicans more often than not because we are center-right and we're focused heavily on economics and getting the government out of the way. That is our stated goal and mission right from the get-go, is that people tend to thrive a lot better when government is not standing artificially in the way, creating barriers to success and someone's own expansion of their own rights. One of the fun things that we get the opportunity to talk to folks about is the economy and the economy and the economy. In fact, we're even knocking doors on the economy right now. And when we show up at someone's doorstep, one of the first questions that we ask them is, how much is the government impacting you and your family, and what is the biggest barrier? And 80 to 90% of the respondents at the door right here in the Cowboy State say it is the economy, it's inflation, it's those type of things that are tied directly to their dollar and how much they can stretch their dollar for their own family's happiness. So that being stated, we focus on the economy because that's what folks are interested at the door. That's where they want to drive, and we're here for it. That's the most important thing that we could be doing.
Oh, great. And people can check you out at cowboysforprosperity.org. Am I right?
That's right. Cowboysforprosperity.org. We've got all sorts of fun stuff on there. We got a Tax Cut and Jobs Act calculator, so you can actually see how much you and your family will be saving with the recent passage of the One Big Beautiful Act. One of the fun parts about that is we've heard from the left multiple times and folks all across the country that this only benefits the rich. I'm not a rich man by any stretch of the imagination. I think if anybody that's listening is in agriculture themselves, plug into that calculator and see how much your savings actually account for. Now, granted, this is heavily dependent on dependents. That's where the real savings are. I always get a chuckle when somebody's like, only the rich benefit. Last I knew, a family of six like mine with four kids, nobody considers rich, especially with two of them now in college. It's definitely hurting my pocketbook. That being said, my savings are substantial and I'm not a rich man.
Yeah. That's great. So today we're going to be debunking a lot of this stuff around the One Big Beautiful Bill. But before we go, or before we start in, I want to take a minute to point out that almost all of the major talking points that we've been hearing out there against the Big Beautiful Bill are coming from the CBO, which is the Congressional Budget Office, or at least analysis from the CBO. And it's an office that has routinely gotten things wrong in the past. You know, critics have hammered the CBO for years for its wildly inaccurate predictions. The American Enterprise Institute, a DC think tank that I read pretty regularly, put out a report this spring calling out some of the serious problems in the CBO model. According to to AEI, the CBO assumes long-term interest rates will stay low, even though rising debt should push them up. That's just one example. They also say that CBO's economic growth assumptions are too optimistic on many fronts, too blind to long-term drag like slower productivity. So this means the deficit predictions could be off by trillions in either direction, right? I wanted to say that just to put it out there, because when we start throwing around numbers like 3 trillion, which is a big deal, just remember that a lot of economists are saying that this is based on outdated or flawed data. Now, it's not to say there isn't spending in this bill, and we'll get to that and the criticisms around it, but let's just start in first. Tyler, in plain English, what is the Big Beautiful Bill? What does it do?
So the One Big Beautiful Bill takes into consideration reconciliation between the House and the Senate and the executive. So a lot of that's got a lot to do with budget, and more budget. That's one of the reasons why numerous provisions of the One Big Beautiful Bill, when it went to the Senate, were pulled out by the parliamentarian. There's something called the Byrd Rule over in the Senate, where it says reconciliation bills can only have something to do with the budget. Otherwise, they're not germane to the bill. And some of those provisions were pulled out in the final version that went through the Senate. That being said, essentially, folks can look at this as an annual spending bill for the federal government, I think is the best way to put it.
Yeah. So let's start with the loudest talking point, which is, of course, and I think one that even changed a couple of Republicans' minds, which is that the bill explodes the deficit. CBO, with its issues, has said that it's going to add $3 trillion. To the debt. I think to be transparent, I have real concerns with the spending in Washington and the fact that Republicans seem to have just given up on reducing the deficit, which is, I think, a big problem. What's inside the bill? How do you feel about the spending?
I think the spending is that's a great place to start. And I think it's important that we start directly there. The biggest spending provisions within the legislation happen to be on border security and defense spending. I would also like to point out that due to the defense spending in this legislation, what we're seeing from the DOD is a relatively flat budget request this year because they got all their asks in this legislation. A lot of that has to do with Golden Dome and those types of things that kind of update as far as our homeland protection is concerned. And when it comes down to homeland protection, I personally think that is actually a good spend on defense spending. When we're putting Golden Domes over other countries, you'll see me on the front lines fighting that through and through. This is homeland protection. And then the immigration aspects, the border security aspects, we're seeing a huge spend by hiring new ICE agents. And then we're also seeing a big spend specifically on some of the new border security walls and those types of things. So that is a big, big spend. As far as border security strategy, something that we see as a good is $46.5 billion for barriers, roads, and certain technology. One of the things that we see as a spend that we're not exactly super pumped about is billions of dollars to expand detention capacity. Those detention capacity aspects is kind of taking into consideration everybody that needs to be gathered up versus the actually truly harmful individuals that have arrest records in the United States, those types of things. We'd much rather see those detention capacities be focused on those individuals versus everyone. So the detention capacity spend is huge under this legislation. And then, like I said, the DOD's spend that is currently going to be put in place.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of the reasons that I don't have a major objection to the Big Beautiful Bill, just the overall lack of, because really where the deficit spending where the Congress, I think, needs to be looking is in entitlements. I mean, obviously, and Paul Ryan understood that, lots of Republicans understood that. It's just going to take a tremendous amount of political courage, and there'll be a price to pay for, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Because, I have no problem spending into illegal immigration. And certainly, as you know, I have no problem in defense spending whatsoever.
Right, right. You might be a little bit more of a war hawk than I am, Amy. So
I'm pretty sure I am.
I think we can both agree, though, that our biggest priority should be the homeland security aspects of our Department of Defense. And that is the majority of the spend coming out of the One Big Beautiful Bill and something that my organization certainly aligns with.
Yeah. I would agree with that. So the next, I think, big one is it's a handout for billionaires. I've seen it all over Twitter. And of course, Twitter is the worst place to go to get any kind of information because it's just filled with all kinds of clickbait. But what do you say? I mean, the left says the richest Americans get the biggest cuts and working folks get crumbs. Are there true? I mean, you've got a calculator. You said that already. What would you say about it's a handout for billionaires?
Yeah, so it's unequivocally a media talking point. And I guess just to call a spade, it's an absolute lie. And we're looking at a permanency put in place, and this is permanent now. This isn't a 5-year extension or anything like that. The Senate did an awesome thing. Senator John Barrasso, right here from the Cowboy State, led the charge on making sure that these tax cuts are permanent. And so just to talk about a left talking point, right? They say this is only for the super wealthy individuals. If that was the case, then why does a child tax credit go from $1,000, which is what the old Tax Cuts and Job Act was at, to $2,200 per child? That is a huge deduction increase for working families across the Cowboy State. That is big time savings. Yeah. For a family like mine, we're looking at anywhere from $6,000 to $9,000 in savings. $6,000 to $9,000 that I get to keep in my own pocket and put towards my own children instead of paying the federal government, to use a term I like to use that'll make you flinch a little bit, to make more bombs, right? I get to keep that money right here in the Cowboy State and use it in my economy. That's real money. And I have yet to see anybody on the left debunk that, because it's actually in the bill. It's a real thing. So those tax savings are huge. But also there's tons of other tax savings that come with it. We all love our local businesses right here in the state of Wyoming. They're fantastic. One of the great things that's part of this legislation is adding permanency for business provisions. One of our priorities was getting permanency for those business provisions, that bonus depreciation and R&D expensing. Really, the Trump administration was pushing for them to only last the course of the presidency, and that would absolutely boost economic activity during the president's term. Just this one change accounts for near doubling of the GDP growth projection on the increase in the Tax Foundation's modeling. That's not CBO, that's Tax Foundation, which is very rarely proven wrong. So that's a big deal. And then you've got SALT expansion. That's a state and local tax deduction, which was increased to $40,000. This increased deduction, it actually phases down to $10,000 starting at an income of $500,000. This lasts 4 years and goes back to the Tax Cuts and Job Act original cap of $10,000 in 2029. So that's something that hopefully we'll be working on at that time, as far as putting that permanency so that you can deduct what you're actually paying in your local and your state taxes. Thankfully, in the state of Wyoming, we don't have an income tax, but some of those taxes can still be deducted. More savings right here in the Cowboy State, where you can keep your own money in your own pocket. We also really supported the fact that the foundation tax increase, the House version had an excise tax increase on net investment income for charitable foundations, which thankfully was removed by the Senate. Huge priority for us. And then tax on fringe benefits paid by exempt organizations was also removed. The House's previous treatment of fringe benefit costs as subject to the unrelated business income tax was removed by the Senate. This was previously repealed under the original Tax Cuts and Job Act and created really an unnecessary burden and complexity on exempt organizations.
Sounds like the Senate was on its toes. Sounds like the Senate was,
Yeah. 100% why we're running around thanking Senator John Barrasso and Senator Cynthia Lummis, because they did yeoman's work over in the Senate as far as cleaning up a lot of stuff. And ultimately, one of the biggest reasons why we supported these provisions so much is right now the federal government, and still, let me make no mistake, we were facing a fiscal cliff. The taxpayers in the United States were about to see the largest tax increase in history if the Tax Cuts and Job Act was not permanently extended or extended at all without this legislation. December of this year would have been a horrible month for all of us here in the Cowboy State and across the United States, just because of what a tax burden increase we would have all seen. Imagine this. We were at $1,000 per child for that child tax credit, we would have gone down to pre-2017 levels, which would have been $500 per child. Now we're at $2,200. The tax savings are ginormous, unless only billionaires have children, which I guess the left is assuming, but they're clearly wrong.
I think it's really been, I mean, I think because the country's so divided and the rhetoric is just so loud that we've obviously really missed how important this bill is in terms of those kinds of permanent tax cuts. Because that's a big deal. It's hard to get that. It's really hard to get that. So you have to see that's a massive win for the middle class all over the country. And it isn't a massive win per se for billionaires. You know, the left's, you know, envy and class envy and wealth envy is so, I mean, it's so tiresome. It's not to say that our billionaires don't pay. What did I read somewhere that we are at the level of, it's something like 45%. So 5% pay over 45% in the country, the highest, those highest earners, the billionaires, as we would say. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. It gets old fast, but
it does. And to be honest with you, I mean, Americans for Prosperity is a nationwide organization, right? So we're involved in elections across the country and elections right here in the Cowboy State. I am super excited about midterms. I think it's going to be more fun than we've had in a long time because everybody that voted no, we're absolutely going to be hanging door hangers saying so-and-so voted for the largest tax increase in the U.S. history because they did. By a no vote, you voted for the largest tax increase in U.S. history. I mean, that's just flat what it is. Yeah. And I think if this was a standalone legislation, I think there's several Republicans like Thomas Massey and Rand Paul, who are great fiscal conservatives, that would have voted for that legislation. Tying everything in a bundle is a rough deal for them. I'm not going to hang my hat on them. But for the left, absolutely. Absolutely. They 100% voted for the largest tax increase in U.S. history, and I will be at their doors.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the midterms and what we're going to see, obviously, I think the left feel pretty comfortable that they have the kill shot, which is it guts Medicaid. Pretty certain that that's going to, because I've already been seeing all the pundits talking that this is going to be the thing. And it is a major criticism, right? They're saying that this kicks millions of people off of Medicaid and gets food assistance like SNAP. I think CBO, maybe CBO or NPR was claiming 12 million people would lose coverage. I really appreciate some of the analysis I've seen, again, from the American Enterprise Institute, talking about, if you remember, Tyler, back in the day, we had from the left Pajama Boy talking about healthcare in his pajamas, right? Well, AEI would like us to have, pardon me, but would like us to have Porn Boy, because they had a really great analysis about how many able-bodied working men are on Medicaid, sitting in their house, surfing porn, and having their healthcare paid for. So talk to us about it guts Medicaid. True?
No, completely false. Completely false. This is one of the wild fantasies of the left that they're trying to hang on the right. And it's just, in my opinion, it is not the pivot that they should be making. First of all, there's no cuts to Medicaid in this legislation, unfortunately, because I would actually like to see those cuts. But that is, I might be a little farther right than some of the individuals in the House and the Senate. That being said, there are reforms. And this is what the Democrats are saying, that these reforms are going to hurt so many Americans. So the reforms are largely around eligibility. All we're saying, all this legislation says, is we're going to check more often if you're actually still eligible for Medicaid. That's it. Uh-huh. That is it. And they're also going to be checking to see if you're dual enrolled, if you're enrolled in Wyoming and South Dakota, as an example. If you're enrolled in multiple states for the same services, that's not the way the law is supposed to work, and you are no longer eligible for one of those states at that point. So what the left is really saying is that they know there's a lot of people abusing this social safety net that we have for folks that actually need it. They know they're abusing it, and they want to protect those individuals.
Well, it was always intended for the working poor and the elderly. I mean, that's what it is supposed to be. So if we've got a whole bunch of able-bodied, you know, working age men, what the heck?
Right. And then on top of that, we've got this great piece that is just and I don't think anybody would argue with this either. If you're an able-bodied individual that is not disabled and you're between the ages of 18 and 40, you have to try and get a job.
Yes.
That is a crazy thought. Like, all of a sudden, their left is worried about there's going to be people kicked off of Medicaid because they don't think they should have to try to find a job if they're an able-bodied adult without a disability. That's insane to me. Like, nobody on the street, no family out there is working their tail off to pay for health insurance for somebody that's sitting on their couch, in your words, porn boy, right? Nobody wants to fund that individual.
Yeah,
like, nobody's in favor of that.
Right. I mean, that truly is waste and fraud. I mean, that's inside the system. And in doing some research before this interview, Tyler, I was kind of sifting through a whole bunch of different talking points. And I came upon a question that was asked of an NPR reporter on a panel about this. And it was probably the best answer I saw. And I don't think she probably intended or meant for it to be a good answer, but she was asked if this is a major cut to Medicaid. And she said, no, it's not a cut. It's a reform, which I think is exactly the Republicans' talking point. They need to get, you know, stronger on that. But she essentially said, really what it does is just require people to have to fill out more paperwork. And I think that's, I mean, that's truly, from what I've read and understand, it's just, you know, the old Reagan trust, but verify. It's just verifying. You say you qualify for this, let's verify that.
That's right. That's right. And I don't think your average, well, I know for a fact, because we're at the doors talking to people and asking these questions. And one of the big questions that we asked, do you think that there should be some requirements on those that are receiving funds from the federal government in regards to this social safety net? And we have those requirements across the board. We have those requirements, multiple different types of requirements for SNAP, for unemployment, all of those aspects. And it's an important thing we need to be doing. And we need to be doing more of that right here in the Cowboy State too. I'll give a good example of it. We're constantly hiring door knockers to go out and hit doors. The majority of respondents and applicants that we get will not show up to an interview, will not respond back to an email. The reason why is they have to check the box and say, yes, I applied for so many jobs this week. What they're not counting on is Tyler turning all of them into to the Department of Workforce Services, which I absolutely do. If we ask you for an interview and you don't respond to us or you don't show up at your interview, that's fraud and we're turning you in.
Yep.
So we do need to expand those opportunities in the state of Wyoming, because as a Wyoming taxpayer, I don't think Wyoming taxpayers are on board with perpetrating fraud. And that's what the left is endorsing right now, is perpetrating fraud.
Yeah. No, listen, Americans, I mean, we are a generous nation and we have what I would say is a generous social safety net, but we should be verifying it, because there's no reason to be overly generous and allow this kind of fraud. And people do work the system. There's no doubt about it. We know that. I think these reforms are long in coming and I'm glad to see them. And certainly there's probably a lot more reform that could happen.
Right.
But it is, exciting to see that we did do that.
There is something else that I did want to cover, because we hear the left talking an awful lot about rural hospitals. First of all, they don't know a damn thing about rural hospitals, because none of them live, very few of them actually live out in the sticks. Usually that's, you know, especially here in Wyoming, we see a lot of farmers and ranchers, agrarian type society living out there, very independent, that handle their own business. But just the same, the left is talking about how rural hospitals are going to close because of these reforms, thereby assuming that everybody that lives out in the country must be defrauding Medicaid. And that the only reason these hospitals that we have survive is because of this fraud. Well, I don't think anybody in Wyoming wants to prop up a hospital that is committed to fraud. And I don't think any of our hospitals actually do that. I happen to be married to a healthcare worker, and I know she's not committed to fraud. So where are these fraud hospitals at that were being propped up? And on top of that, the bill also does provide $10 billion a year in rural hospital transformation funding. So what that means is that these rural hospitals that are out there that are actually not participating in fraud, which the 99.9% of them are not participating in fraud, they're going to have an opportunity to go after some funds to help revitalize those rural hospitals. And I think that's a good use of those tax dollars.
Yeah, because I know we've seen the headlines about the rural hospitals in Wyoming being very close to insolvency or maybe at insolvency.
Right.
So, yeah, do we think this is going to help in any way, or is this just a tiny little portion of whatever troubles they're in?
I think it's, you know, we've heard the chicken is falling argument from the hospitals across the country, not just Wyoming, every year, that if they don't do this, these hospitals are going to close and fall apart. We heard that this year on certificate of need repeal, which is a whole nother story, but just the same.
Great bill, by the way, and you can, by all means, please explain it, because it was a great bill.
It was super fun. It's an archaic piece of regulation that was on the books in the state of Wyoming and across the nation for decades upon decades, that said you could not build a new nursing home facility within 30 miles of another nursing home facility unless they were capacity or over, which is insane, because that's a lot like asking McDonald's, hey, do you mind if I put a Burger King right across the street? Are you cool with that?
I bet I know the answer.
Yeah, McDonald's is going to say absolutely not. And in fact, in the last 10 years alone, we had 18 new nursing home facilities that had tried to be built in the state of Wyoming. These are jobs. This is a healthcare facility. This is a place where our loved ones can go. 11 out of those 18 were denied because of that artificial boundary, right? It's not about the best choice. It's about what a law says at the time. That was repealed by the Wyoming legislature this year, not without fight from various different organizations, but just the same, the Wyoming legislature made the right decision and repealed. Shout out to Representative Geringer, right out of Cheyenne there. He was the prime sponsor of that. I think he's your representative.
My representative, Tyler. Yes.
Right. Yeah. Shout out to him and Senator Gary Crum, who led it in the Senate. Those individuals worked hard. Senator Gary Crum saw the firsthand effects of being denied to have a new facility in his hometown. He saw the firsthand effect of that, and he was ready to chew on wood over that deal. And he's a lot of the reason it got passed through the Senate so easily.
Yeah. Well, these are the little things. I mean, they're so important. They seem small, but they're really, really big because they're so important. So,
right.
Now, it's not a myth, so we're not going to debunk it, but I have to ask because my mother seemed very excited about this and I have no idea. I assume it's true, but she has this understanding that she may not have to pay taxes on her Social Security benefit now. Is this correct or not correct?
Yeah. So that was another piece that we saw. We saw that on overtime. We saw that on tips, and we saw that on Social Security. Now, each one of those is capped at a certain amount of income. Once again, the Republicans benefiting the rich. Oh, wait, no, it's only benefiting the middle and lower class. I guess we must have read that wrong. So in this regard, Social Security is capped. I believe, don't quote me on this, it's $75,000 a year in annual income. And that's a deduction that those individuals now get that money back at the end of the year. So that's fantastic. Same with tips. It's capped at a certain income level annualized, and then they get all of those funds back. And the same with overtime. So benefiting the lower and middle class in a big, big way. I really think the Democrats screwed up big time on this deal because the next tax year coming around this spring, going right into midterms, Republicans will be returning more to individuals' pocketbooks than they've ever seen before. An individual will be able to keep that money. And honestly, promises made and promises kept from this Republican majority.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, this bill has got a lot of really, really good things in it. And I think, who's not for some more money in their pockets? The Edmonds House is definitely for that.
Yeah.
So before we end, and this is probably going to be a longer conversation, I wanted to talk a little bit about a part of the original bill that sparked a firestorm here in Wyoming, and that I think kind of shadowed over the good stuff in the One Big Beautiful Bill. And that is Senator Mike Lee's proposal to allow the federal government to sell off public lands to private buyers. So, I mean, I think you might agree with me, but I'm going to say I am not in favor of selling off public lands to private buyers.
Right.
Only in instances where it's landlocked around municipalities, places where it's not heavily used. I'm not in favor of selling to private hands because obviously it means the lands are forever locked away then. I think Governor Gordon said something really interesting when I interviewed him this week. He was talking about the federal government's failure to implement NEPA and that he's asking for reforms and going to Congress and hoping he can get it. And his suggestion is that they should throw it back to the states, right? And allow the states to take over that NEPA process when the feds can't get it done on time in a timely manner. They're always, dropping the ball. And also that the feds should then support the states in the litany of lawsuits that will happen if this should happen. I think that just that one example is a great example of how much we need to continue to push for federalism, pushing these things back on the states. And I think federal land is a great example and one that I think is really, really important. What I want to talk about, though, is obviously the Wyoming legislature in 2016 commissioned this report about the state taking it over. The report was not great, because there's a lot of complicated issues around taking those lands back from the feds and allowing the states to administer them. First off, let's talk about the One Big Beautiful Bill and Mike Lee's provision. Let's start there, and then we can go on to states resuming. What were your thoughts on it? Did you see some things that needed to be debunked? I mean, it's gone. It's not in the bill, and it was taken out before the bill was passed, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I think this is another case of the left, the media lying to everyone and owning the argument. They did a fantastic job with their lies on this one, because what was put out was Senator Lee and the Senate is going to sell all public land. And that's what was put out. And for every one of us, that's a terrifying moment, right? We're all Western States people. We're raised here. Our families are here. We're multiple generation. This is who we are. It's part of our DNA. And so for a lot of folks, that was terrifying. Like, oh my God, except we forgot to check if the left was lying again. And yeah, they were actually lying again. When things got drilled down and you actually look at the amendment, you know, and he even softened it even more in his final version, trying to get it through. What it ultimately looks at is 0.5 to 0.75% of all federal lands in the West that do border a municipality where they do need increased housing. They would first go to the state to purchase. And if the state didn't want to purchase them, they'd go to the locals, the county or the municipality to purchase for the purpose of land of housing development. And then if that didn't happen, then at that point, it could go to private for the purpose and only the purpose of housing development. And in fact, even in the amendment, it specifically stated that that land could never be changed for any other use. It had to be utilized for the purpose of housing development. And that might sound crazy to some folks that might be listening, that might live east of Wyoming. And that's fine. For those individuals, I would ask them to go look up the Western Divide between lands that are owned by the federal government. As an example, 2% of the state of North Dakota is owned by the federal government. 48% is owned in the state of Wyoming. It is a huge divide. We don't even own half of our state. And when you look at areas like Jackson, Wyoming, is a really good example of a bad example. 98% of that entire county, Teton County, is owned by the federal government, and they don't have any room for expansion. Most of their workers are driving in from Driggs, Idaho. And during the winter times across that pass, it is certainly treacherous. And there's no room for these people to actually own houses in the areas that they work. And that's happening across the West in these beautiful landscapes where we've got these little picturesque towns. There's no places for them to actually build a home because all of that land is locked up. And that's specifically what Senator Lee's amendment was looking to fix. It wasn't looking to sell the Tetons or the Yellowstone or anything like that. That is a lie. That is unequivocally a lie. We're talking about 0.5 to 0.75% of federal lands in 11 states that do border a municipality where they do need more housing. And that's what the amendment did. And everything else is just so much wind.
Yeah. I think there was a sort of pushback gently. I think there was a whole lot of bad communication about a lot of the bill. And I also think there was a whole lot of really vagueness in it. So I would ask a couple of things. What kind of housing development? I mean, obviously you gave Jackson, that's a bad example. So I'm not going to hammer you on that one because even if the feds freed up land to sell, it would have to be heavily subsidized because-
right.
Understanding is the bill said that land had to be sold at the highest possible value. In right. Teton County, doing that means you're going to have to subsidize the crap out of that to get affordable housing for workers. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. So I'm not going to, we'll move on. But Rawlins, Rock Springs, and other places where they might, was there rules around what kind of housing?
Yeah, federalism is the rules of roost in this amendment. Would have been a state-ran program. So the state would have had to set up those rules and boundaries in place and also take into consideration the types of areas that they're building in. Obviously, like you just stated, Rawlins is a very different animal than Jackson. And so the rules would look different. So I suspect that there would have been a lot of local input as far as setting up those rules and probably even them running their own business.
Yeah. I mean, because I saw, and I'm sure you did too, just the tremendous mobilization of the hunters and outfitters across the country who were really unhappy. I mean, even their, you know, counterparts in DC that are there to protect lands for hunters were pretty unhappy with this bill and did not feel like it had the right kind of safety nets around it. Whatever, you know, in the end of the day, I think if Senator Lee's going to come back, obviously there needs to be a whole lot more collaboration and making sure that everybody is at the table because there's so many people that have a vested interest in these lands and they're all going to be really trigger happy when it comes to
Amy, both of you and I have been part of this debate for over 10 years now. This is not an old topic for us here in the state of Wyoming. And during that debate process, I would be fascinated to know if those conservation groups are truly interested in finding a solution. Because in the over 10 years of debate I've been going over this, I've never seen one conservation group step forward with a solution to this land that is locked up by other private land, by this land that is inaccessible, by this land that is blocking access and expansion for affordable housing in these areas. It's always been a flat no. So I would be truly interested to know if they are actually willing to tackle this issue. As it stands right now, I've never heard anything out of these guys.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I have in other podcasts on this subject asked the question because I have asked the question about what about the states, right? Because I am fully in support of states taking ownership of these federal lands.
Right.
I mean, for a number of reasons. The number one reason is the federal government does a really crappy job of it.
Right.
And number two, and I've punctuated this, if you were upset, if you're listening to this, you were upset about what was happening with the sell-off of the lands, you felt frustrated, you had to call a 202 number 1,000 miles away from you to try to get a hold of your federal delegation, and you felt really, well, that's the reason federalism is so important. Because if the state owned it, you probably have the personal cell phone of your state legislator. You can certainly get a hold of Governor Gordon really, really easily. And the state has a much more vested interest in doing it well when their voters care that much about it. So, but you are right. In having that conversation with conservation groups and others that I've spoken to, they're still a hard no. They're just a no.
Yeah, yeah. I'd be super interested if there is a way, if there is a way for it. I doubt it. I mean, to be honest with you, I you know, just like you, you've dealt with these organizations before too. Most of them are, in my opinion, hoodwinking hunters and anglers across the West into believing that they're truly concerned about conservation of the West. And really, they're just concerned in locking up the land. These are the same organizations that supported Biden's plan in adding to multiple use conservationship, where they could lock up federal lands in perpetuity without any multiple use, any access being allowed, without any hunting, any of that. These are the same groups that supported that activity. So I'm very hesitant to believe that they're ever going to come to the table. I personally think they're not good actors.
So that provision is out of the bill and didn't get passed into the bill. Let's just, as two former legislators, talk for a minute about this idea of Wyoming assuming ownership of the lands, because I love that. I mean, I'm still talking about it, Tyler, because I love this idea so much. And I know that there's the 2016 report, and I accept there are real realities around it. But I think that, here's the thing, the report was written for the state thinking about it like an overnight takeover, not some like a 20-year plan. And I think if Wyoming starts laying the groundwork now, if we start building local expertise, streamlining permitting, creating revenue models that aren't tied up in these federal approval, we could shift incrementally. I think we also have to change the Constitution to create a separate class to accept these funds in so that they're not tied directly to our schools, which I don't think they should be.
Right.
Because, you know, it's important for people to realize that Wyoming manages state lands right now. It does not manage public lands. There is a difference, and these would be public lands. So tell me your thoughts.
Yeah, I think one of the first things that we need to identify with that report was it didn't take into consideration what the excise funds would have looked like if Wyoming owned the minerals. If Wyoming owns the minerals, Wyoming's woes go away pretty permanent
as long as we're going to do a little woohoo.
Yeah. If we own our own minerals and we're receiving the excise tax full stop on those minerals, even with the Powder River Basin, Trona, uranium mines, the new rare earth mines that we're seeing, oil and gas, the list goes on. We don't have an issue with money as far as funding the control of these lands. At that point, we have to have the discussion, where are we going to find the people to do this? You know, in an ideal situation, there'd be a lot of federal employees looking for work all of a sudden, where we could probably just pivot them to working for the state at that point. You know, Amy, I'm up in the Black Hills of Wyoming. We're one of the last spots in the state of Wyoming that actually has a sawmill in it. And that sawmill's probably got a year left of life to it before it's gone. And it's not because it's not new equipment or anything like that. It's 100% because the Black Hills National Forest has told everyone in this area there's no more wood. We're flat out, guys. This is the Black Hills of Wyoming. First of all, the reason why it's called the Black Hills of Wyoming is because the hills are black. The timber is that dense and that good a timber that you can't see the ground, right? And so that federal land and that state land has a great story on it here in the Black Hills. We, like a lot of forests, saw the bark beetle come through. And it was devastating across the West until it got to the Black Hills. The Black Hills of Wyoming and South Dakota partnered up on state lands to find a solution, and find a solution they did. They saved our forest by finding a way to actually beat back the bark beetle. It goes into this whole story about cutting and chunking. But just the same, you can fly over the Black Hills, and you can absolutely see where the federal land is and where state land is. And the major difference is the state decided a long time ago that wood is good, and being very focused as far as timber thinning makes a healthier forest. And the state of Wyoming still has healthy forest in the Black Hills, whereas the federal government, it's really gone down drastically. Thankfully, due to our efforts with state and private landowners, and then eventually convincing the federal government this is a good idea, we're able to save the Black Hills wholesale. But just the same, here we are facing the closure of one of the last sawmills in the state of Wyoming, all while President Trump is signing executive orders to say increase production. The Black Hills National Forest is limiting production. They're going against their own executive, and we're just out here screaming in the wilderness. And this situation would be a non-situation if the state actually owned its own land.
No, that's a perfect example for people to understand why it would be so important. I mean, why it is so important, why it would be just such a game changer if we could take ownership. Now, you know, I don't know what a senator from any of the eastern states or a congressman would feel they want to do this. I mean, this is always the problem that Congress is going to have to act. But it's also sort of the same feeling I had about some of the discussions around Mike Lee's proposal when they were talking about using these funds to reduce the deficit in some sense. That makes me crazy, Tyler. Because I don't think the West should have to pay for the spending that's happening all over the country. And that's exactly what it would be doing. It would be on the backs of all of us Westerners losing this lifestyle that we love so much by losing. And let's be clear, we would lose something locally, but tourism is our number two industry. People come here because of all of this open space and the beauty.
Well, and so that's another talking point that we constantly hear from these groups is the state's going to sell off that land, guys. The state's going to just sell it off. It drives me nuts because, like you just stated, Amy, number two on our economy list in the state of Wyoming is tourism. The state of Wyoming is not going to cut its own throat and kill future generations. No. In fact, in multiple pieces of legislation where we explored this opportunity in the Wyoming legislature, it was always listed every time that the state of Wyoming shall not sell that land. And yet the left still voted against it.
Right, yes. Well, I sure hope that someone takes up a project in the legislature and creates, you know, there needs to be some kind of working group. If you, you know, enough with the resolutions, fine, sign your name to them, pass them, whatever. They do nothing. If you want to do this, and I think we should, we need to get serious about creating a committee, putting together plans, long-term plans, and start making incremental changes to be ready. Whether or not it happens, I sure hope it does. I think it would be an amazing thing for the state of Wyoming and for all the Western states to own those lands. Just as you said, just from the health of the forest perspective, would be pretty intense. Tyler, thank you so much for being on here. Let me tell you something. Your BS detecting is at a great level. So we have to, I love it. We have to have you more. So thank you for being that guy today. Really appreciate it. I really appreciate you being here.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Amy. I really appreciate the opportunity and I can't wait for the next time.
Great. Until next time, this is Let's Talk Wyoming. Have a wonderful weekend.